Hello, everyone, and welcome to the VITA podcast, where we help educate military veterans and their spouses on opportunities in Web3. Our plan is to host a series of industry leaders, many of whom are veterans or spouses themselves, so that we can learn about their journey down the crypto rabbit hole while understanding opportunities for transitioning veterans in the industry. I'm Chris Perkins, president of CoinFund. I'm a combat Marine veteran who spent 15 years on Wall Street before transitioning into the crypto space. And before we begin, I would like to thank our sponsor, Luca, who's dedicated their time and resources to make this podcast possible.
For our 30th episode, we'll be speaking with Navy veteran Nick Riegel, founder of Ironclad Financial. Hello, Nick.
Hi, Chris. It's very nice to be on the show today.
Awesome. So tell us about your background, man.
Yeah, so I was a Naval Academy graduate in 2004. I majored in systems engineering. After I graduated, I served on the USS Porter in Norfolk, Virginia for 4 years. And I worked at Dahlgren, Virginia for 2 years. And then after that, I got out, worked for Deloitte, and then ended up at Merrill for about 10 years and decided back in 2022 to kind of leave and start my own RAA.
So we call you type of naval officer SWOs or SWO daddies. It's a really, really challenging career. I had a roommate who was a SWO, and you want to tell us about what it's like to be a surface warfare officer?
Yeah, I mean, the joke is that you could put a SWO in a room with nothing to do, and then he'll say after the full weekend how busy he was. I think we find ways of always kind of looking at making things more complex sometimes. But it was definitely a eye-opening experience for me. Being on the Porter, I did a fleet up there, which means that I stayed on for my second tour. So I was on there for a total of 4 years, and then just seeing different captains, different personalities. We did two deployments overseas, one to the Black Sea and the other to the Horn of Africa.
What was your role in the ship? Like, what does that mean? What's a day in the life of a SWO during deployment?
Yeah. So my first deployment, I was in the weapons department. So I was a gunnery officer. So a lot of that was just making sure of kind of maintaining all the weapon systems, testing, keeping account of all the ordnance that we had on board, and then also helped with the force protection. So the overall security of the ship and a lot of kind of admin items that go along with that. But then on the other side, being a SWO, you're also helping drive the ship. A lot of my days were kind of managing the division and then serving a watch for 6 to 8 hours on the bridge, navigating as the officer of the deck.
Those are both some hairy waters. I know that there's a lot of anti-piracy missions out there. Did you do a lot of that kind of work and boarding?
Yeah, in fact, the second deployment was off the coast of Somalia, and we were involved. The USS Porter was involved with a ship that was hijacked called the Golden Nori. And so we were directly involved in anti-piracy operations. And in fact, through that situation with the Golden Nori, I had an upfront encounter with pirates.
Well, and I imagine the pirates didn't do so well in the end.
No, they decided to leave after. But it was a good couple months of just kind of tracking them and then basically creating like a barricade around them so that they couldn't leave the ship. And then some negotiations happened and things were taken care of.
Always an adventure. So you came back home, and tell us about your transition.
So I came back home and I was looking at what the next step was. I mean, I was at the time, my wife, we were engaged. We were looking at what we could do post military, what we could kind of where we were going to live and things like that. So a lot of it was just trying to search for a new occupation that kind of had some of the elements of being in the military, but also kind of gave a little more of a post-military at the same time. So finance was, I think a driver. And I think there's a lot of us that kind of end up in finance.
You wanted to go into finance. How did you land a job? Did you start networking with fellow Academy guys and ladies?
Yeah, networking had a huge part of that. I think networking was always the first step of just seeing what other people did. LinkedIn at the time was also a good resource. And then also through the networking, kind of talking to other companies. And I actually ended up working for Deloitte first because it was a great transition at that time with my top secret clearance to find work that was very similar. So I think it gave me a bridge for a year or so to acclimate to the civilian world, but still be part of the military slash federal kind of operational kind of op tempo, if you will.
Got it. So you leverage your clearance. You're at Deloitte doing a lot of, sounds like, defense consulting. And then you decided to take it a step further and jump into finance. Tell us about that.
Yeah. So I was at Deloitte for a little bit less than a year, and I wanted to make a transition. I wanted to kind of move out of the project management, the defense sector space. And I was looking at opportunities with finance. And I noticed that there was basically all the positions that I was really interested in required the Series 7. And so I didn't have the Series 7. I didn't have any real financial background. I had an interest in it for many years, and I was actively doing investing and options trading and things on my own. And so then I kind of pivoted my search to say, okay, what area could I leverage all my leadership and all my planning experience while still obtaining the Series 7? And so I talked to a couple other folks, and I did more networking. And based off of my conversations with different managers and different companies, one that I actually ended up with was the Merrill Lynch in the Ballot Kinwood office, which is outside of Philadelphia. Really liked the office manager there, really thought I had a good connection, and ended up joining Merrill as part of their professional management development, or PMD program at the time, which is basically to train new financial advisors.
Yeah, that's a pretty prestigious role. Like the Merrill Financial Advisors, or was it the Thundering Herd? What do you call it?
Yeah. At the time, it was the Thundering Herd. Now, with Bank of America taking more of a focal point, I think it's more of a challenge of keeping that identity of Merrill, not Bank of America sometimes. So you
launched this career as an FA with Merrill. And I imagine that gave you some additional skills that you were able to cultivate.
Yes, that was in 2011 is when I made that transition, in the fall of 2011. And then went through the program, and part of the program was to build your own book, but also kind of learn more about investment processes. And I learned a lot about non-discretionary versus discretionary investment planning, ways to scale a business. And after a couple of years, there was a larger team that needed basically to hire more advisors because they were growing too fast and they needed that capacity. And I was invited to join their team. That was in 2013 or so. And from there, I learned even more best practices and really kind of led to kind of honing in on how to really work with high net worth individuals.
And so along the way, it sounds like you got into crypto. Tell us about that journey.
Yeah, so that actually started in 2015. I had a client, and we were just having a normal kind of financial planning review, and part of that was a portfolio. And of course, through any type of planning process, one of the questions I asked is, okay, so is there anything else that you want to talk about, or is there any other kind of asset allocations that we might want to look at? And he said, well, I have this position in Bitcoin, and I heard of Bitcoin before. One of my buddies, again, from the military back in, actually as early as I think 2012, was mentioning Bitcoin because he was out in DC and he heard about it. And so I never really got into it at that time because I wasn't really sure how it worked. And my attention was more focused on a new career shift and applying to different positions and everything. So fast forward in 2015, I took a different approach and I said, you know, it's something I really don't know that much about, but let me look into it for you. And I'll figure more out about it. And so that started the conversation of how would this fit into a portfolio and how does this really fit into the overall client mindset, if you will. And I came back and he wanted to invest more, and we looked at it from just like a risk adjusted basis of what his objectives were and his liquidity needs and all the planning stuff. And I said, well, if it's something that you're interested in, the worst case scenario, if this thing goes to zero, it would have zero impact. But the other side, asymmetrically, is if this continues to grow, then it might offer you a interesting kind of asset allocation. And so we basically kind of agreed to just kind of track it. At the time, Merrill really had no research or any capabilities. Fast forward a couple of years later, and Merrill started picking up some research but it was very limited what I could actually work with clients on from digital assets. It wasn't something that Merrill wanted us to really have any involvement with or advise on. And so in 2022, I recognized that if I really wanted to include more alternative investments and specifically digital assets, that would have to be under my own independent RIA. And that was my main driver for leaving Merrill and starting Ironclad Financial.
Wow, that's a pretty cool story. So you decide to leave. It's not easy to be a founder.
Yeah.
Right? I work with them every day. Tell us about that transition and some of the challenges that you faced and how you overcame them.
I think the act of, I was with Merrill for 10 years and I didn't leave because of any issues. I was on a team, high net worth advisory team. I was slated to be one of the next generation of advisors. So I had this large team. All I had to do was just stay there. And so everything was kind of on track. I didn't have to pursue crypto. I didn't have to pursue these things that Merrill really didn't want to be involved with. I could just stay the status quo and continue. So the first challenge was, am I really going to give up being a significant part of the next gen advisor? Because the two senior advisors were looking to leave in the next couple of years. In fact, I think one is going through that transition now. So just staying, I think the biggest challenge was that inertia or that momentum to just kind of carry me through and say, this should not be a big impact on my practice. The backside of that though, is because I was involved personally with decentralized finance back in 2020, I knew firsthand just how powerful this new concept was going to be. And so the back and forth of the reality of where things were today versus where things could be 10 years from now, that I recognized that if I wanted to be where I really wanted to be, I needed to do that under my own umbrella, because a large company is not going to move, just like as I would not have wanted to move, or this back and forth just from my own little position. A large company itself is just, that's not their focal point. That's not their motivation to take more risk than their, you know, quote unquote return. Now we're seeing a difference now with institutional investors and things like that. But at that time, that was really, I think before those conversations really took hold. And so that was the first struggle. The second struggle was the reality. I really liked all the people that I was working with too. So just kind of leaving that and going from a team-based environment to then being a solo practitioner, starting something from scratch, just recognizing that how little did I really know about the RIA space, because I was in this bubble, if you will, this warehouse. It was here's your technology, here's your processes, here's everything we do by the book, here's a whole system. And being from the military, we do like to have systems, but we also like to have independence. So I think that's why veterans tend to do very well in these different scenarios. And so it was kind of pushing myself to recognize the adventure of doing something on my own, the risk of basically starting all over again. But at the same time, I thought to myself, what would be my biggest regret? Is it staying here and realizing the coulda, shoulda, would've, or was it to just take that leap of faith and realize, you know what, I'm going to land on my feet, things will work out, but if I don't take the risk now, I'm not going to take it 1 or 2 or 3 years later. It's just going to be harder as I transition more and more in that main role. And so I just said, you know what, 2022, this is going to be the year that I'm going to leave.
I totally agree with that. I feel like I advise folks, take risk while you're young. That's the time to maximize your risk taking, right?
Yeah.
It's harder as you get older and, you know, you got mouths to feed and things like that. So anyway, what are you advising your clients now? I know each client's different. You have to be a fiduciary, but like vis-a-vis the crypto space, like how are you thinking about portfolio construction? And would just love to know the contours of your advice.
Yeah. So with clients, again, each one's a little bit different. There's some clients that have zero crypto exposure, and I haven't even really looked to add crypto exposure to them right now because it's just not what's in their best interest. But for other folks, it definitely aligns with their risk parameters and what they're looking for with more of a holistic asset allocation beyond that traditional 60-40, 60% stocks, 40% bonds, right? And within the alternative investments, but also just within tech-heavy industries or folks that have a lot of exposure to technology, I find it's very compelling, especially since many clients already do have crypto outside. And it was more of having a conversation and then recognizing now that I have the capabilities of working more directly with clients, we can have more direct conversations and we can get more involved. And you find out just how down the rabbit hole some of these guys really are. So I would say the first group of clients, they're already in crypto. And so with me now, it's more of how do we look at your security mechanisms? Are they using a MetaMask wallet versus a multi-signature wallet? So it's more about just improving their processes and ensuring that they have the right kind of awareness of the risks, especially if they self-custody. But it's also very interesting working with people that self-custody because it creates a whole nother paradigm of, yes, they can invest with me on traditional assets and I can manage those traditional portfolios, but now I can actually give advice on a non-discretionary, non-custodial basis on these digital assets. And I find that is a much greater growing segment of my client base now than I would have expected.
So we have two questions. The first is you talked about the 60-40 traditional portfolio construction. How do you think crypto changes that in the future? Where are we going to settle?
BlackRock really kind of changed the game in terms of changing that narrative. And I think they're just the beginning of this trend of moving more assets on chain. And so when we look at what is possible, yes, a money market account or a treasury account is not really going to move the needle. Most folks will look at that and say, oh, well, I don't really need that. I can just get treasuries or I can just buy blah, blah, blah in my custodial account, which is true. But I think what really changes the game is the fact that that can now be collateralized or part of a system that will just continue to grow. BlackRock is not going to stop with just one tokenized asset. They're just looking and experimenting, and they're going to continue to bring more and more solutions. And I know Uniswap right now was served a Wells notice, but that might be fortuitous in the sense that we might finally have some more clarity. I mean, it would be best not through the court system, but if that's the way it is. But I think once that gets resolved and people can start recognizing how more and more assets, especially real assets, can be brought on chain, then asset allocation is not just going to be a analogy I would use is when people talk about asset location in terms of a retirement account or a taxable account. Yeah. Now we can talk about, do you want this in your custody or non-custodial or self-custody? It just has a whole nother element for folks, especially for those that are more multinational or folks that want more diversification outside of the United States.
Yeah, I agree with you on the Uniswap. I tweeted about that. Like, clarity is going to be a good thing, which is super positive. I hear you on the type of asset and how that could be interesting in construction, but I would still think that a money market fund is still part of that 60-40 traditional mix. Like, where do you think crypto native assets fall into 60-40? Do they have a role?
Yeah, I think if we look at the asymmetric kind of risk returns and the level of volatility, depending on the individual client, I could see that being anywhere from a less than 1% kind of allocation for people to just kind of, I think right now you can get exposure to crypto through not just the Bitcoin ETFs, but now there's more and more funds that are adding exposure to, let's say, IBIT or through Bitcoin futures, for example, within these other multi kind of tiered ETFs or investments. So even if they're not trying to get exposure, it'd be very interesting a year from now how many other investments will just have an allocation. I think commodity funds are already starting to incorporate Bitcoin in their commodities basket. So if commodities, and especially with inflation right now, in the sense that we're going to be higher for longer potentially, how do we look at protecting purchasing power? I think there's a significant benefit adding commodities or asset classes that could encompass things like Bitcoin or Ethereum.
So you're on the front lines every day talking to clients and how has the Bitcoin ETF changed their perspective? Has that been like the light bulb for many of these folks who previously weren't in the space? Now they're like, now that it's so funny, Bitcoin, it's commodity, but we make it a security. Then everyone, we say, no, it's not a security. Then we make it a security and then people want it. Has that changed the conversation? Are you seeing a lot of folks now saying, well, I'm interested. And, you know, we've always believed that it's going to take some time for, you know, the full steady state adoption to occur, because, you know, people like you, Nick, you're out on the front lines, you're playing golf, or you're out to dinner with your clients, and it takes a while for them to get comfortable. So how is the ETF, Bitcoin spot ETF, going to change the game here?
Well, it brought up a very easy way to have a conversation of, for folks that, I think a lot of folks are just overwhelmed with how little time they have and just how distracted they are with so many things going on. And so for them to say, okay, let me open up a Coinbase account or a Kraken account and figure that out and then purchase this Bitcoin, they're just avoiding doing those extra steps, right? But then when something like the BlackRock iBit comes out, or all these other firms, VanEck and et cetera, come out, suddenly that's no longer on the table. So I think from a cognitive dissonance standpoint, that goes away. Now suddenly it's accessible and they can buy it with accounts that they already have. What I was kind of surprised by, and in hindsight, it made perfect sense, is just how many folks that already have crypto suddenly said, you know what, I don't really have I still have a custodial IRA, but I'm just going to buy iBit, for example. And so suddenly something that you have self-custody folks from a taxable kind of standpoint have tons of crypto that you would never think that they really need any more crypto. For them, it's a way of kind of passing it to the next generation, I think, of having it in a retirement account. So that's what surprised me. It added a lot of conversations about adding things as a percentage. And with other things, I think it could potentially add more of a risk-adjusted return. And so that conversation started happening more and more. And then just the idea of owning crypto, it really kind of shocked people. It's like, well, wait, why is this an ETF? If Bitcoin's worthless, then why is there an ETF about it? It just completely changed the narrative away of Bitcoin just being funny money, if you will.
So we're past the Bitcoin ETF. What's next? And what excites you about the crypto space?
The logical conclusion would be that Ethereum ETF would be next. But then, of course, there's this kind of overhang with I think, more of a political overhang than anything. So I still think there's still room for an Ethereum ETF. I just don't know when. But people aren't waiting for the ETFs anymore. They want to get more involved in on-chain transactions, to get more involved with understanding what decentralized finance is. And this is very interesting at a time where certain organizations are going after some of the largest, most robust protocols that are out there instead of focusing their efforts on really the bad actors. It does have this other side effect of, oh, wait a minute, what is maker taker fees? Wait, what's going on? Wait, what is a liquidity pool? So actually, I mean, it's serving as a great, when someone tries to prevent you from doing something, it's that Streisand effect. It's oh, wait a minute, maybe I should be doing this. And so I think this ad's actually driving more attention to what DeFi is. And in that case, I'm very excited about on-chain tokenization as another motivation for folks to take the time, set it up, learn about this. And especially if advisors can be involved in that process without having custody, I think that changes the game. So I'm very excited for a company called L1, where they're really helping to facilitate a platform where advisors, asset managers, and individual clients can all coordinate, where the clients have full custody via their hardware wallet or a safe wallet, for example, through like what used to be called Gnosis Safe, like the multi-sig wallets. Yeah. And they can get advice or at least get reviews on their positions. And L1 is integrated through Zapperfi. So they have all this information, and it's just another way of working with folks. So I'm very bullish on on-chain wealth management, tokenization, and also DeFi, even at a time where I think people are kind of thinking like, oh, wait, this is the time to get more involved, I think.
I couldn't agree more. So what advice would you have for a transitioning vet? You know, sounds like you're having a great run. What advice would you give them?
Learn. I think if they're going that initial transition and they know that they dropped their papers and they got, let's say, a year left, this is the time you should be networking with as many people as possible. I think most vets, even if I don't even know them, reach out to me on LinkedIn, I will respond to them. I might not be able to help, but ideally, I might be able to point them in their direction with someone that could help them. And for the folks that are interested in crypto and specifically in being a financial advisor with cryptocurrencies or digital assets as part of that, that portfolio, I mean, I would love to have that conversation with them, to offer them advice. And I think just generally learn as much as you can. And from there, then start looking at what is the most interesting to you, and then find the companies or the projects that are in that space. And, you know, folks like yourself that are really broadcasting this to veterans, I think is a great starting point as well.
Are you hiring at all, Nick? How big's your team? Are you a one-man show, or you have a team behind you?
I'm a one-man show, and I'm in the process of kind of looking at how to add on headcount, because I'm recognizing just it's like being that one-man coder, right? At some point, you recognize that you are no longer the guy that is operating in the day-to-day, that you do need someone that is on the operational side. And unfortunately, or fortunately, I guess from a founder standpoint, I'm responsible for everything else. So I am definitely, I would love to network with more advisors, especially those vets that are in crypto.
Awesome. And what skills would you be looking for any of those transitioning vets? How could they prepare themselves for an interview with you?
Yes, I think one is a question of if they have any certifications like the Series 7 or another kind of certification. I think that's one route. The other route is if they do have like a background in computer science or programming, coding, because I mean, let's face it, with alternative investments, that's great, but there's also this AI kind of overhang that we haven't even discussed. But I think artificial intelligence combined with coding, combined with digital assets, will be a powerful kind of combination.
Yeah, we spend a ton of time at the intersection of crypto and AI. Just, I guess my last question would be, you brought it up, how's AI going to transform your business and your livelihood?
I think it's going to be one of the best kind of, it reminds me of like going through like the late 1800s, where you had like the railroads, electricity, and all just electricity, all these different things come out. Here we have crypto, we have artificial intelligence. It's just going to completely, are there going to be human advisors? Yes. But will those human advisors be leveraging AI? Absolutely. And the ones that do not leverage it are going to be left behind, because the ability to provide more advice, more customized, personalized advice, at a lower cost. Company firms like my IRA right now, I'm looking at, you know, how will financial advice be given? Because many things, you can't just automate all advice, but you can definitely automate parts of it. And then if you have a human advisor, you can help coordinate when it makes sense and when it doesn't make sense. And so I just see that as a huge paradigm shift, and it should definitely be one of the biggest disruptors.
Yeah, which makes for very exciting times.
Absolutely.
So awesome. Anything I should have asked?
I don't think of anything else. I think we kind of covered, you know, my background, how I got motivated into crypto, the pros and cons of being in crypto, and then just being a veteran. I think the last thing I would say is just veterans, to me, have a natural curiosity, and they're willing to kind of look beyond the status quo. So I think we always find ourselves kind of always looking to kind of have a growth mindset.
Sounds good. And how can people connect with you, Nick?
Best is through my website, ironclad.financial, or through LinkedIn. Last name is Riegel, R-Y-G-I-E-L.
Excellent, sir. And thank you so much for coming on today's podcast. Excellent, excellent information and feedback. We're really lucky to have someone like you, another founder just trailblazing in the space. Also wanted to thank our sponsor, Luca. Couldn't do this without you. And for those of you who are interested in learning more about Vita, please connect with us on LinkedIn or Twitter. And if you have ideas of folks that we should bring onto the podcast, please reach out to me on Twitter at PerkinsCR97. Thanks again, Nick. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, Chris.